age range to create true beneficial comparison. Dr. J believes if she can nail the right removal time from the mounds, she can develop a system that will take a human from flesh to skeleton much faster than the current method, laying them out and waiting for bugs, animals, and nature to do their work. On the day John Compost was first put in the wood chips, a layer of vivid green alfalfa had been spread over his body in an attempt to raise the temperature of the mound, which it seems to have done. But composting also needs moisture to work, and as we pulled off more of the pile, it became apparent that the alfalfa layer had had the effect of zapping the moisture from his body. John Compost was essentially mummified, his white papery flesh still stuck to the bones along his iliac crest and femur, which I brushed clean in soft strokes. Harsh body composting lesson number one, don't overdo the alfalfa layer. Dr. J discovered something interesting as she uncovered his head and the top of his right shoulder, the only body parts not covered in alfalfa. Heavy spring rains had trickled down from the top of the hill and underneath the tarp, soaking that area. Here, far from being mummified, the bones were clean, dark, no flesh to be found. In fact, on his sternum were the beginnings of Swiss cheese-like holes, where even bone had begun to decompose. Despite that encouraging discovery, John Compost was far from being transformed into rich, dark soil, as Katrina had hoped. John had been encased in the mound for 5 whole months, and there he was, still hanging out, mummified. Livestock composting of a full-grown steer can take as little as 4 weeks when mechanical aeration is involved. Offal from a butchery only takes 5 days. Human composting had a long way to go. Dr. J was unfazed. "You learn a little bit each time," she shrugged, and signaled us to begin covering John up again, after adding more water and dismantling the ill-fated alfalfa layer. The experiments being done at Forest recall Italian anatomy professor Lodovico Brunetti's attempts in the late 1800s to create the first modern cremation machine. Brunetti's methods were very on brand for the industrial era, employing what scholar Thomas Lecoeur called a austere technological modernism. Brunetti presided over multiple failed experiments, but those experiments represented the beginning of a new era in the history of the dead body. After all, industrialized cremation machines are today the dominant mode of body disposal in almost every developed country. The first corpse that Brunetti cremated was the body of a 35-year-old woman placed in a brick furnace. The experiment was not unsuccessful, as the furnace did reduce her body down to 5.5 pounds of bone chunks, but the method took too long for the professor's satisfaction, 4 hours. Brunetti thought it might expedite the process to chop up the body pre-cremation. Corpse number 2, a 45-year-old man, went into the same brick furnace in 3 layers. Level 1 for limbs, level 2 for the head, chest, and pelvis, and level 3 for organs and other viscera. The cremation still took a frustrating 4 hours to complete, but now the bones that remained weighed only 2.5 pounds. Katrina has considered this tactic. Multiple composting experts have told her if you really want to compost efficiently, you'd chop up the body first. The unsettling suggestions from experts don't stop there. There are those who say she must add manure to the pile, and one avid composter who sent her an email reading, "Dear Ms. Spade, I am interested in your project. I have had excellent luck with my compost pile because I use leftover urine from hospitals. Have you considered that?" "Did you write back?" I asked. "I had to politely decline on the hospital urine. Is it a good source of nitrogen?" "Yes." "Is it fast?" Probably yes. Am I going to put a body in it? No. Brunetti, undeterred by the thought of pulling the dead apart, decided in his next round of experiments to go hotter, putting various body parts into an altogether different furnace that produced coal gas, a substance used for electricity in the 19th century. This furnace was several hundred degrees hotter and took 2 hours longer, 6 hours total, but the end result was bones that were completely carbonized, zapped of all organic material. All traces of what made the human a human, including the DNA, though the professor would not have understood this at the time, were gone. In his 1884 paper, Brunetti wrote of cremation, "It is a solemn, magnificent moment, which has a sacred, majestic quality. The combustion of a corpse always produced in me a very strong emotional arousal. As long as its shape is still human, and the flesh is burning, one is overcome by wonder, admiration. When the form has vanished, and all the body is charred, sadness takes over." By 1873, Brunetti was ready to debut the results of his experiments at the Vienna World Exhibition. His booth, number 54, in the Italian section, featured various glass cubes containing the results of his experiments, bones and flesh in varying degrees of disintegration. Brunetti's cremation technology represented a chance for society to skip over decomposition and incinerate the body down to its inorganic material. He hoped to industrialize the process, to do it as quickly as possible with the efficiency of a factory line. According to Lecoeur, modern cremation, as Brunetti saw it, was a problem for science and technology. The message was clear. Nature, left to her own devices, was far too sloppy and inept, taking months to do what a 2,000-degree blast furnace could do in mere hours. A sign at Brunetti's booth at the Vienna exhibit read, "Vermibus irepti, puro consumimur igni," or "Saved from the worms, consumed by the purifying flame." Almost 150 years later, both Katrina and I would disagree with Brunetti that only flames can purify. The poet Walt Whitman spoke of soil and earth as the great transformers, accepting the leavings of men and producing such divine materials. Whitman marveled at the ability of the earth to reabsorb the corrupt, the vile, the diseased, and produce new, pristine life. There is no reason to zap away your organic material with gas or flame when there is good to be done with the leavings of your mortal form. Dr. J headed back down to the tent in the parking area to upload data from the electronic logger, which had been placed on the chest of John Compost, to record the temperature spikes in his body experienced while in the mound. That left Katrina and me to start uncovering the second mound, containing June Compost. The 78-year-old woman was emaciated by disease at the time of her death. Her mound consisted of pure wood chips and was at the bottom of the hill, uncovered in the shade. As we got deeper into the pile, the dirt exposed larval beetles and grubs. The soil inside the pile was abundant and dark. Compost is often referred to as black gold. But the presence of the insects was not ideal, as it meant there was still something inside the pile serving as a nutrition source, a feast to keep these creatures occupied. Then I hit June's femur, covered in a thick white leftover of decomposed fat, the consistency of Greek yogurt. Apologies, Greek yogurt fans. As we uncovered more, we found the woman at the very end stages of decomposition, mostly down to bone. June Compost's problems were the opposite of John Compost's. There was enough moisture, which is why she had been successfully taken down to bone, but without enough nitrogen, the temperature in her mound never got high enough to reconfigure her bones to soil. Neither June nor John Compost had been a success. But this was only the beginning of Katrina's experiments. More bodies will come into the forest facility to be composted. At Wake Forest University, a law professor named Tanya Marsh is assigning her cemetery law students to comb through state laws to discover how to legalize recomposition facilities in all 50 states. At Western Washington University, a soil scientist and composting expert, Lynn Carpenter Boggs, will begin experiments with human-sized animals, small cows, large dogs, shorn sheep, the occasional pig, all predeceased. There are already studies underway on what the composting process does to mercury amalgam fillings in teeth, whose toxic release into the air is one of the biggest environmental concerns about cremation. Lynn called me on the phone the other day to talk about the teeth study, Katrina said, and casually mentioned, "I dug my own grave and slept in it last night." She's a pretty serious practicing Sufi. "Damn. Dug her own grave and slept in it," I replied. "Yeah, death is part of her spiritual practice. She's much more than just a lover of livestock composting." It is worth noting that the main players in the recomposition project are women, scientists, anthropologists, lawyers, architects, educated women who have the privilege to devote their efforts to righting a wrong. They've given prominent space in their professional careers to changing the current system of death. Katrina noted that humans are so focused on preventing aging and decay, it's become an obsession. And for those who have been socialized female, that pressure is relentless, so decomposition becomes a radical act. It's a way to say I love and accept myself. I agree with Katrina here. Women's bodies are so often under the purview of men, whether it's our reproductive organs, our sexuality, our weight, our manner of dress. There is a freedom found in decomposition, a body rendered messy, chaotic, and wild. I relish this image when visualizing what will become of my future corpse. When death care became an industry in the early 20th century, there was a seismic shift in who was responsible for the dead. Caring for the corpse went from visceral, primeval work performed by women to a profession, an art, and even a science performed by well-paid men. The corpse, with all its physical and emotional messiness, was taken from women. It was made neat and clean and placed in its casket on a pedestal, always just out of our grasp. Maybe a process like recomposition is our attempt to reclaim our corpses. Maybe we wish to become soil for a willow tree, a rose bush, a pine, destined in death to both rot and nourish on our own terms. Spain, Barcelona. The American funeral home exhibits a suspiciously uniform aesthetic. Squat mid-century brick, velvet-curtained interior, an easy aroma of Glade plug-ins, covering over the antiseptic smells from the body preparation room. By contrast, the Ultima Funeral Home in Barcelona is Google headquarters meets Church of Scientology. It is minimalist, hyper-modern, projecting the potential for cult-like activity. Its three stories feature floors, walls, and ceilings of elegant white stone. Wide balconies allow you to step outside and overlook the gardens. Not parking lots, gardens. One wall is floor-to-ceiling glass, exposing a panorama of the city stretching from the mountains to the sea. Stop by the espresso bar to take advantage of the free Wi-Fi. The Mediterranean sun streamed through the window and reflected off the white floor. Blinded by the glare, I found myself in a perpetual cross-eyed squint during conversations with Ultima's attractive, well-groomed employees, including Josep, the dashing man in a suit who ran the whole operation. In addition to Josep, 63 people work at Ultima's well-oiled facility. They pick up bodies, prepare them, file death certificates, meet with families, run funeral services. Ultima handles almost one quarter of all deaths in Barcelona, which works out to 10 to 12 bodies a day. Families choose between sepultura or incinerar, burial or cremation. Spain, thanks to its Catholic roots, has been slower to adopt cremation than most European countries. Its cremation rate is at 35%, with urban Barcelona closer to 45%. To understand the death rituals of Barcelona, you must understand glass. Glass means transparency, unclouded confrontation with the brutal reality of death. Glass also means a solid barrier. It allows you to come close, but never quite make contact. Ultima boasts two large oratorios, chapels, and 20 family rooms. A family can rent one of these rooms and spend the entire day with their dead, showing up first thing in the morning and staying until the doors close at 10 p.m. And many families do. The catch is that the entire time, the body will be behind glass. You have options as to the manner of glass you'd prefer be placed between you and your loved one. If you select a Spanish-style viewing, Ultima will display your loved one in their coffin, surrounded by flowers, behind one large pane of glass, akin to a department store window. If you prefer the Catalan style, Josep and his team will slide the open coffin into a snow-white display case in the center of the room. Either way, Ultima can maintain a steady temperature around the body of 0 to 6 degrees Celsius, 32 to 42 degrees Fahrenheit. Behind the scenes, there were long corridors where the bodies in wooden coffins awaited their big moment. Pint-sized Alice in Wonderland metal doors opened to allow Ultima staff to slip the body into its display or glass casket. "What makes the glass casket Catalan style?" I inquired. My interpreter was Jordi Nadal, head of the publishing company that released my first book in Spain. Jordi was a Zorba the Greek character, dropping Carpe Diem-themed bon mots at every opportunity, keeping your wine glass full and squid and paella on your plate. "Our Catalan families want to be closer to the dead," was the answer. "By putting them behind the glass like a zoo exhibit? What trouble are the corpses planning on causing exactly?" is a thing I did not say. The fact was, I had spent the whole week in Spain doing interviews with the national press on the ways modern funeral homes keep the family separated from the dead. Ultima had read those interviews. That they had allowed me to make this visit at all was a miracle and showed a willingness to engage on alternative methods that no American funeral corporation has ever shown me. I didn't want to push my luck. That's not to say there wasn't any tension. One employee, an older gentleman, asked if I was enjoying my time in Barcelona. "It is gorgeous. I don't want to leave. Perhaps I will stay here and apply for a job at Ultima," I said in jest. "With your views, we would not hire you," he joked back, not without a slight edge to his voice. "Do you have this phrase in Spanish, keep your friends close and your enemies closer?" "Ah, yes," he raised his eyebrows. "We'll do that." The people I spoke to in Barcelona, regular citizens and funeral workers alike, complained of how rushed the process of death seemed. Everyone felt the body should be buried within 24 hours, but nobody was quite sure why. Mourners felt pressure from funeral directors to get things completed. In turn, the funeral directors protested that families wanted things fast, in less than 24 hours. Everyone seemed trapped in this 24-hour hamster wheel. Theories for this time frame ranged from historical factors, like Spain's Muslim past — Islam requires bodies to be buried swiftly after death — to the warm Mediterranean weather, which would allow bodies to putrefy more quickly than elsewhere in Europe. Prior to the 20th century, it was not uncommon to believe that the corpse was a dangerous entity that spread pestilence and disease. Imam Dr. Abdul Jalil Sajid explained to the BBC that the Muslim tradition of burial in the first 24 hours was a way to protect the living from any sanitary issues. The Jewish tradition follows similar rules. Such fear across cultures inspired the developed world to erect protective barriers between the corpse and the family. The United States, New Zealand, and Canada embraced embalming, chemically preparing the body. Here in Barcelona, they placed the body behind glass. The shift toward removing those barriers has been slow-going, even though prominent entities like the World Health Organization make clear that even after a mass death event, contrary to common belief, there is no evidence that corpses pose a risk of disease epidemics. The Centers for Disease Control puts it even more bluntly. The sight and smell of decay are unpleasant, but they do not create a public health hazard. With this in mind, I asked Josip, the owner, if they would allow the family to keep the body at home, sans protective glass boxes. Though he insisted Ultima rarely received such a request, Josip promised that they would allow it, sending their employees out to the home to close the holes. We took a freight elevator downstairs and stepped into the body preparation area. In Spain, bodies are so swiftly sent off to sepultura or incinerar that they are rarely embalmed. Ultima did have an embalming room with two metal tables, but they only perform full embalmings on bodies that are being transported to a different part of Spain or out of the country entirely. Unlike the United States, where aspiring embalmers must pursue the overkill combination of a mortuary school degree and an apprenticeship, in Spain, all training is done in-house at the funeral home. Ultima boasts of importing embalming experts from France to train their staff, including the man who embalmed Lady Di. In the body prep room, two identical older women, in identical button-up sweaters, with identical crucifixes around their necks, lay in identical wooden coffins. Two female Ultima employees leaned over the first woman, blow-drying her hair. Two male employees leaned over the second, rubbing her face and hands with heavy cream. These bodies were on their way upstairs, destined to repose in glass coffins or behind glass walls. I asked Jordi, my publisher, if he had ever seen dead bodies like this, without the glass barrier. With his typical verve, he allowed that, although he hadn't, he was ready for the encounter. "Seeing the truth like this is always elegant," he explained. "It gives you what you deserve as a human being. It gives you dignity." Johan was a more salt-and-pepper version of his brother Josip. He ran Cementeri Parc Roques Blancas, White Rocks, one of Ultima's cemeteries. All Spanish cemeteries are public, but private companies like Ultima can contract to run them for a designated length of time. The electric golf cart buzzed up and down the rolling hills, passing above-ground mausoleums and columbaria. Roques Blancas resembled many American cemeteries, with bright bursts of flowers laid out on flat granite headstones. One aspect, however, was drastically different. Johan radioed one of the cemetery's groundskeepers to join us at the top of a hill. There were no graves up here, just three discreet manhole covers. The groundskeeper bent down to unlock the heavy padlocks and slid back the metal circles. I squatted beside him and peeked in. Beneath the covers were deep holes carved into the hillside, filled to the top with bags of bones and piles of cremated remains. Someone from North America might recoil at the idea of an idyllic cemetery harboring mass graves filled with hundreds of sets of remains. But this was business as usual at this Spanish cemetery. The dead at Roques Blancas start out in a ground grave or in a wall mausoleum. But the dead haven't purchased a home at the cemetery as much as they have rented an apartment. They have a lease, and their time in the grave is limited. Before a body is placed into a grave, the family must lease a minimum of 5 years decomposition time. When the corpse has decayed down to bone, they will join their brethren in the communal pits, making way for the more recently deceased. The only exceptions are made for embalmed bodies, again, rare in Spain. Those bodies may need more like 20 years for their transition. Joan's crew will periodically peek in on the embalmed bodies and say, "Oh, okay, buddy, not done." The corpse will have to stay in its grave or wall crypt until it's ready to join the collective bone club. This grave recycling is not just a Spanish practice. It extends to most of Europe, again baffling the average North American who views the grave as a permanent home. In Sevilla, in the south of Spain, they have almost no available cemetery land. The cremation rate there is 80%, very high for Spain, because the government subsidizes cremation down to a cost of only 60 to 80 euro. It is economically prudent to die in Sevilla. Over in Berlin, German families rent graves for 20 to 30 years. Recently, the cemetery land has become not only prime real estate for the dead, but for the living. With so many choosing cremation, long-standing cemeteries are being converted into parks, community gardens, even children's playgrounds. This is a hard transition to reconcile. Cemeteries are beautiful spaces of cultural, historical, and community value. By the same token, they possess great cultural and restorative potential, as this Public Radio International piece reported. Then there's the Berlin graveyard, mostly cleared of headstones, that is now a community garden, including a small Syrian refugee garden with tomatoes, onions, and mint. The old tombstone carver's workshop at the entrance to the graveyard now hosts German language classes for refugees. It's a space that's been abandoned and used for burying people, used for, now, gardening and cultivating human beings in the best way possible, said Fetewe Tarigan, the head gardener of the community project. Roques Blancas is attempting to do more than just bury the dead. They have won awards for their green initiatives. Their fleet of vehicles is electric, including the hearse shaped like a silver bug, conceived by students at a Barcelona design school. The 10 hectares of land protected squirrel colonies, wild boars, and special houses for bats. The bat colonies are cultivated to control the dangerous invasion of the Asian tiger mosquito. Although Roques Blancas received some bad press for daring to associate their cemetery with bats, vampires, the vile undead. Environmentally sound though these initiatives may be, Roques Blancas is not a natural cemetery. The dead are required to be buried in wooden coffins, in granite crypts, stacked in layers of 2, 3, or 6 people. This is puzzling. Why not place the body directly into the soil, without granite? This would allow the bones to decompose completely, meaning there would be no need for the communal grave space, thus freeing up the land. "We just don't do that in Spain," Joan said. Joan has decided to be cremated, but seemed to understand the contradiction in that choice. "It takes 9 months to create a baby, but we destroy the body too easily through industrial cremation processes." He thought for a moment. "The body should take the same 9-month time to disintegrate." I whispered to Jordi, "It sounds like he wants a natural burial." Spain is very good at being almost green in its postmortem ideas. On our tour, we passed through a grove of trees, Mediterranean and native to this area, of course. Roques Blancas will plant a tree and bury 5 sets of your family's ashes around it, making it a literal family tree. They are the first cemetery in Spain to offer this option. Rocas Blancas's family tree is similar to the wildly popular biodegradable urn, BioCERN, created by a design firm in Barcelona. You might have seen it floating through your social media feed. BioCERN resembles a large McDonald's cup filled with soil, a tree seed, and a place for cremated remains. One of the most popular articles on the BioCERN is called, "This Awesome Urn Will Turn You Into a Tree After You Die." It is a lovely thought, and a tree may grow from the soil provided, but after the 1800-degree cremation process, the remaining bones are reduced to inorganic basic carbon. With everything organic, including DNA, burned away, your sterile ashes are way past being useful to plants or trees. There are nutrients, but their combination is all wrong for plants and don't contribute to ecological cycles. BioCERN charges $145 for one of their urns. The symbolism is beautiful, but symbolism does not make you part of the tree. Rocas Blancas has two cremation retorts, or machines, at the cemetery, which cremate 2,600 people every year. Walking in to see the machines, I was surprised by two men in suits flanking a light wooden coffin with a cross emblem, waiting with hands folded outside a preheated retort. "Oh, you're waiting for us. Excellent. Gracias." I am always excited to witness a cremation. It never gets old, no matter how many you've overseen or performed. It is powerful to be in the presence of a corpse mere moments from being transformed by fire. Johan took us on a brief tour of the cremation room, including the 15-year-old cremation machine used for family-witnessed cremations. It was significantly nicer than the industrial warehouses back home. "The walls are marble from Italy. The floor is granite from Brazil," he explained. 60% of our families come to witness the cremation," Johan announced. Here's where my jaw hit the polished granite floor. "I'm sorry, 60%? I reeled. That is an enormous number, far higher than the percentage in the United States, where many families don't even know that they have the option of witnessing the cremation. Before the cremation began, Johan brought us just outside the room, behind, are you ready for it, 3 panes of glass, stretching floor to ceiling. They were identical to the 3 panes of glass that had separated us from the body at the funeral home. "Why do you use the glass for cremations?" I asked Johan. "The angle is such that you can't see fully inside the oven, to the flames," he replied. It was true. Try as I might, I couldn't quite see the fire, just the edge of the cremation machine. The two men slid the coffin into the brick-lined machine. When the heavy metal door came down, they pulled a classy wooden door across the front of the retort, hiding the machine's industrial facade. Barcelona was the land of almost. They had initiatives for eco-cemeteries, animal conservation, and the growth of native trees. Their bodies were not embalmed and were buried in wooden coffins. Almost a green burial, except for the granite fortress the coffin was required to be placed in. They had witness cremations that 60% of families attended, and funeral homes in which the family could stay the whole day with their loved one. Almost a paragon of family interaction at death, yet there was glass separating the family from the body at the viewing and at the cremation, setting up Mom as a museum exhibit. I wanted to be self-righteous about the use of glass, but couldn't for this simple reason. With its elegant marble and glass, Ultima had provided the one thing that the United States needs more than anything: butts in the seats. People showed up for death here. They showed up for day-long viewings, sitting close vigil with the body. They showed up for witness cremations, 60% at this location. Perhaps the barrier of glass was the training wheels required to let a death-wary public get close, but not too close. The cremation process would take approximately 90 minutes. Johan took Jordi, my publisher, to the back of the machine, where the family does not come. Pulling open a hinged metal window, he allowed us to peer inside the cremation chamber. Fierce blasts of fire shot down from the ceiling and devoured the top of the coffin. Jordi's eyes widened as he took his turn peeking in, his pupils reflecting the flames. For his trouble in showing me around Barcelona, poor Jordi had been rewarded with multiple close encounters with the dead. As we ate what seemed like a 14-course dinner in the city, I inquired what the day had been like for him. He thought, and replied that, when your bills come due, you have to pay them. At my company, I pay my bills. Here at this restaurant, I pay my bill. It is the same with feelings. When the feelings come, the fear of death, I must feel those feelings. I must pay my bill. It is being alive. Japan, Tokyo. Tokudane, the Japanese morning television show, cut to a commercial break. Women in grape suits danced to a pulsing electronic beat. Animated bunnies clipped a toupee on an astounded man's head. Tokudane returned, and the host introduced the next segment, which began with a white-robed monk praying in a temple. There were flowers and incense. He appeared to be presiding over a funeral. The temple was crammed with distraught mourners. The image pulled back to reveal the altar and the source of all this sorrow. 19 robotic dogs. The camera zoomed in on their broken paws and snapped off tails. I watched the TV at the hotel breakfast buffet in rapt attention, eating fried eggs shaped like hearts. Electronics giant Sony released the Aibo, companion in Japanese, in 1999. The 3.5-pound robo-canine had the ability to learn and respond based on its owner's commands. Adorable and charming, the Aibo also barked, sat, and mimicked peeing. Their owners claimed the pups helped combat loneliness and health issues. Sony discontinued the Aibo in 2006, but promised to keep making repairs. Then, in 2014, they discontinued repairs as well, a harsh mortality lesson for the owners of the roughly 150,000 Aibos sold. A cottage industry of robotic vets and online grief support forums sprang up, culminating in funerals for Aibos tragically beyond repair. Once the Tokudane segment ended, I headed into Tokyo full of heart-shaped eggs to meet my interpreter, Emily Ayako Sato. She had suggested we meet at the statue of Hachiko in the Shibuya railway station. Hachiko is a national hero in Japan. Hachiko was also a dog, a real one. In the 1930s, he would meet his owner, an agriculture professor, at the rail station each day after work. One day, the professor never came to meet Hachiko. He had died of a brain hemorrhage. Undeterred, Hachiko returned to the station every day for the next 9 years, when his own death halted the ritual. Dogs are a solid meeting point from a cross-cultural perspective. Everyone respects a devoted canine. Sato-san was waiting when I arrived, a woman in late middle age who did not look a day over 40. She wore a power pantsuit and sensible walking shoes. My secret is walking 10,000 steps each day. I almost lost her several times as we descended into the labyrinthian bowels of the Shibuya station, swept up in the throngs of Tokyo's well-dressed denizens. Perhaps I need to hold up one of those flags that tour group leaders carry, with a skull on it, just for you, she grinned. After 2 turnstiles, 3 staircases, and 4 escalators, we reached our platform. We're safer down here from earthquakes, Sato-san announced. This wasn't a non sequitur. Just that day there had been a 6.8 magnitude earthquake off the coast. I couldn't speak to anyone in Tokyo without them referencing the psychological impact of the 2011 earthquake, with its subsequent tsunami that roared through northeast Japan and killed more than 15,000 people. On the subway platform, sliding glass barriers separated the riders from the rails below. "Those barriers are somewhat new," Sato-san explained. "For one thing, they prevent," she lowered her voice, "the suicides." Japan's rate of death by suicide is one of the highest in the developed world. Sato-san continued, "Unfortunately, the workers have become very efficient in cleaning up the train suicides, collecting the body parts, and whatnot." In the Judeo-Christian view, and thus the dominant Western view, to die by suicide is a sinful, selfish act. This perception has been slow to fade, though the science is clear that suicide has root causes in diagnosable mental disorders and substance abuse. Sin does not qualify for the DSM-5. The cultural meaning of suicide in Japan is different. It's viewed as a selfless, even honorable act. The samurai introduced the practice of seppuku, literally cutting the abdomen, self-disembowelment by sword, to prevent capture by the enemy. In World War II, nearly 4,000 men died as kamikaze pilots, turning their planes into missiles and crashing into enemy ships. Apocryphal but famous legends tell of the practice of ubasute, where elderly women were carried on their sons' backs into the forest to be abandoned in times of famine. The woman would stay dutifully put, succumbing to hypothermia or starvation. Outsiders say that the Japanese romanticize suicide, and that Japan has a suicide culture. But the reality is more complicated. The Japanese view of self-inflicted death as altruistic is more about wanting not to be a burden, rather than about fascination with mortality itself. Furthermore, foreign scholars can look at statistical numbers on suicide, but they will not understand the phenomenon, argues writer Kenshiro Ohara. Only Japanese people can understand the suicide of the Japanese. For me, observing death in Japan was like gazing through the looking glass, everything familiar but distorted. Like America, Japan is a developed nation where funerals and cemeteries are big business. Large funeral corporations play a sizable role in both Western and Japanese markets. Their pristine facilities are staffed by professional death workers. If that were the whole story, it would have made no sense for me to visit. But that is not the whole story. Kukokuji Buddhist Temple, a 17th century building tucked away off a quiet street in Tokyo, is home to a modest cemetery, with aged headstones representing generations of families that have come to worship here. A black and white cat lounged on the stone path. We stepped out of modern Tokyo and into a Miyazaki movie. Yajima Jushoku, Jushoku means head priest or monk, emerged to greet us, an affable man in a brown robe with close-cropped white hair and glasses. In contrast to his archaic surroundings, Yajima Jushoku is a man of new ideas, specifically how to memorialize cremated remains. My kind of guy. Funeral directors in the United States blanch with fear at the thought of a national cremation culture, which would undercut profit margins in embalming and casket sales. In reality, we have no idea what a homogeneous cremation culture might look like, but the Japanese do. They have a cremation rate of 99.9%, the highest in the world. No other country even comes close. Sorry, Taiwan, 93%, and Switzerland, 85%. The emperor and empress were the final holdouts, still choosing full-body burial. But several years ago, Emperor Akihito and his wife Empress Michiko announced they would also be cremated, breaking with 400 years of royal burial tradition. When Kukokuji Temple reached capacity, the priest Yajima could have invested in an old-fashioned cemetery space. Instead, 7 years ago, he built the Ruriden Columbarium. Columbaria are separate buildings for storing cremated remains. Buddhism has always been state of the art, he explained. It is quite natural to use technology alongside Buddhism. I see no conflict at all. With that, he showed us through the doors of the complex's newest hexagonal building. We stood in the darkness while Yajima punched something into a keypad at the entrance. Moments later, 2,000 floor-to-ceiling Buddhas began to glow and pulse in a vivid blue. Whoa! Sato-san and I bleated in unison, stunned and delighted. I had seen photographs of Ruriden, but to be surrounded 360 degrees by luminous Buddhas was overwhelming. Yajima opened a locked door, and we peeked behind the Buddha walls at 600 sets of bones. Labeled to make it easy to find Miss Kubota-san, he smiled. Each set of cremated remains corresponded to a crystal Buddha on the wall. When a family member comes to visit Ruriden, they either type in the name of the deceased or pull out a smart card with a chip, similar to the cards used on Tokyo's subways. After the family keys in at the entrance, the walls light up blue, except for one single Buddha shimmering clear white. No need to squint through names trying to find Mom. The white light will guide you straight to her. All of this evolved, said Yajima. For example, we started with a touchpad, where you type in your family member's name. One day, I saw a very old woman struggling to type a name in, so that's when we got the smart cards. She just had to tap the card and can immediately find her dead person. Yajima headed back to the keypad controller and instructed us to stand in the center of the room. The autumn scene, he announced, and the formation of Buddhas turned yellow and brown with shifting red patches, like piles of freshly fallen leaves. Winter scene! And the Buddhas turned to snowdrifts of light blue and white. Shooting star! And the Buddhas turned purple as white spots jumped from Buddha to Buddha, like a stop-motion animation of the night sky. The majority of columbaria leave no room for innovation. Their design is the same the world over, endless rows of granite walls where ashes reside behind the etched names of the dead. If individuality is a priority, you may be allowed to affix a small picture, a stuffed bear, or a bouquet of flowers. This LED light show could have been a Disney production, but there was something in the sophisticated design of the lights that made it feel as though I were being swaddled in a technicolor womb. The afterlife of Buddhism is filled with treasures and light, Yajima explained. Religious scholars John Ashton and Tom White described the Pure Land, the celestial realm of East Asian Buddhism, as decorated with jewels and precious metals and lined with banana and palm trees. Cool, refreshing ponds and lotus flowers abound, and wild birds sing the praises of the Buddha three times a day. In designing Ruriden, Yajima was creating an afterlife along the path of Buddha. The Buddha lights weren't always this elaborate. One of the early visitors to the new facility at Ruriden was a light designer, and she volunteered to create the scenes from different seasons. At first, the lights looked like a Las Vegas show, Yajima laughed. This is not a toy, I said. Too much. We canceled that. As natural as possible, I said. The work is still happening to create that atmosphere as natural as possible. Yajima invited us for tea inside the temple and offered me a stool brought out for visiting foreigners. He believed I couldn't endure sitting cross-legged on the floor mats for the duration of tea and conversation. I assured him I absolutely could. I couldn't. My legs fell painfully asleep within the first 3 minutes. I asked Yajima why he had designed Ruriden the way he did, and his response was impassioned. We had to act. We had to do something. Japan has fewer children. Japanese people are living longer. The family is supposed to look after your grave, but we don't have enough people to look after everyone's grave. We had to do something for those people left behind. A full quarter of Japan's population is over the age of 65. That, combined with a low birth rate, has caused Japan's population to shrink by 1 million people in the last 5 years. Japanese women have the longest life expectancy in the world. Japanese men have the third longest. More importantly, their healthy life expectancy, not just old, but old and independent, is the longest for both genders. As the population ages, the need for nurses and caregivers is swelling. People in their 70s are caring for people in their 90s. My interpreter, Sato-san, knows this well. She herself is responsible for the care of 6 people, her parents, her husband's parents, and 2 uncles. All are in their mid-80s or early 90s. A few months ago, her great-aunt died at 102. This army of the elderly, the silver market, worked their whole lives, saved money, and had few, if any, children. They have money to burn. The Wall Street Journal said that one of Japan's hottest business buzzwords has become shukatsu, or end of life, referring to the explosion of products and services aimed at people preparing for their final years. Revenues in the Japanese death industry have increased by 335 billion yen, $3 billion U.S. dollars, since the year 2000. A company called Final Couture markets designer shrouds, and specialized photographers create end-of-life portraits to be displayed at funerals. People show up years in advance to purchase their Buddhas at Ruiden. Yajima encourages them to visit often and pray for others, and thereby face their own death. When they die, they will be welcomed by the people who went to Buddha before you. Then there are those who do not plan ahead, who have no close family. Their bodies leave dismal reddish-brown outlines on carpets or bedspreads when they are not found for weeks or months after death. They are victims of Japan's epidemic of kodokushi, or lonely deaths, elderly people who die isolated and alone, with no one to find their bodies, let alone to come pray at their graves. There are even specialized companies hired by landlords to clean what is left behind after a kodokushi. When Yajima built Ruriden, he thought of the man who doesn't have any children and says, "What will I do? Who will pray for me?" Each morning, Yajima enters Ruriden and punches in the day's date. That morning, he punched in May 13. Several Buddhas glowed yellow, representing the people who had died on that day. Yajima lit incense and prayed for them. He remembers them, even if there is no family left to do so. For an elderly man or woman with no remaining family, the glowing Buddhas at Ruiden will act as their afterlife community. Yajima Jushoku may be a powerful priest, but he is also a designer. When I pray, I also think about creating. How do we create something new, filled with dazzling light? How do we create new Buddhas? For him, the act of prayer is essential to creativity. Every time I pray, the different ideas pop up. I'm not a man who sits at a desk to create a plan. It's all while I'm praying. What if Ruiden fills up with ashes? If it fills up, then I will consider a second or third, Yajima smiled. I'm already thinking of them. In the early 20th century, Japan's privately operated crematories were, at least in the eyes of the press, dens of iniquity. The men who operated the crematories were rumored to steal gold teeth from the dead. Even stranger, they were said to steal body parts, which were then processed into medicines purported to cure syphilis. The machines still burned wood instead of gas, which made the process a lengthy one. The family had to leave the crematory and return home while the body burned overnight. Historian Andrew Bernstein explained that, as a precaution against the theft of body parts, gold teeth, jewelry, or articles of clothing, mourners were given keys to the individual ovens, which they had to bring back to the crematory to recover the bones and ashes, like lockers at a bus station. The Mizui Funeral Hall, founded as a public crematory in 1938, introduced a more modern approach. The machines used fuel, allowing the families to handle everything in one day, no keys necessary. Advocates argued that crematories should be rebranded funeral centers and placed in garden-like settings as a form of aesthetic management. 80 years later, the Mizue Funeral Hall continues to operate and still benefits from aesthetic management. The sprawling complex abuts a river to the west, gardens and a playground to the south, and a junior high and two elementary schools to the east. Like Mizue, Rinkai, the crematory I visited, offers the full death experience. That day, 4 separate funeral halls were set up, with funerals staggered throughout the day. Private funeral company employees arrived long before the families with flower wreaths and other swag add-ons to decorate the room. Bamboo, plants, glowing orbs. I was most impressed by the glowing orbs. Social anthropologist Hikaru Suzuki explained that in modern Japan, as in the West, professionals prepare, arrange, and conduct commercial funeral ceremonies, leaving the bereaved only the fees to pay. One of Suzuki's interview subjects, an 84-year-old man, bemoaned the loss of ritual around death. In the 1950s, he complained, everyone knew exactly what to do when someone died. They didn't need to pay someone to help them. Look at young people today in the presence of death, he said. The first thing they do is call a funeral company. They act like helpless children. Such an embarrassing situation never arose in the past. The truly shocking part, his wife chimed in, is that young people today don't seem to be embarrassed about it either. So not only do the young have zero death literacy, they don't seem to mind. Of course, the younger generations raise their eyebrows at the superstitions of the old. The same man admitted that his granddaughter, a medical student, made fun of him when he hearkened back to funerals past, where, when a woman was pregnant, she wasn't allowed to go near the deceased. It was said that if a cat jumped over the deceased's head, the evil spirit of the animal would go into the corpse and make the body rise up. To prevent the corpse from transforming into an evil cat zombie, well, the cat was kept away from the dead. Each of the 4 halls at Rinkai was set up for a funeral of a different elderly woman. Digital photo frames with portraits of the women were placed at the front of the hall near the casket. In her portrait, Mrs. Fumi wore a blue sweater over a white collared shirt. In a tiny side room, Mrs. Tanaka lay unembalmed in a lavender cremation casket. Dry ice, not the rolling fog 80s music video type, tucked around her body to keep her chilled. Her family surrounded her, their heads bowed. Her funeral would be held from 10 a.m. to noon the next day, directly followed by the cremation. The old men assembled in a separate room, smoking, segregated from the general grievers. I remember funeral halls before the smoking rooms, Sato-san told me. Mixing the cigarette smoke with the funeral incense was terrible. The crematory itself, where the bodies were taken after the funerals, was like the foyer of a fancy New York office building, everything made of imposing dark granite. This was the shiny new Lexus to America's old Dodge pickup truck. 10 cremation machines were hidden behind 10 silver doors, meticulously polished, free of smudges. Gray stainless steel conveyor belts deposited the dead into each machine. It was cleaner and sleeker than any crematory I had ever seen. Prices were posted outside the crematory. To cremate an unborn baby cost 9,000 yen, a single body part, 7,500 yen, 2,000 yen to divide up the bones of a grown person into separate urns. also posted was a list of items the family was not allowed to cremate alongside their dead loved one, including, but not limited to, cell phones, golf balls, dictionaries, large stuffed animals, Buddha figures made of metal, and watermelons. Wait, watermelons? Really? That's what it says, Sato-san shrugged. Three or so close family members, including the chief mourner, most likely the husband or eldest son, accompany a body into the crematory and watch it glide into the machine.